promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We'll not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We'll comprehend the word of serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in self-esteem and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We'll intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We'll suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They'll be fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work with them.
Thank you to all the readers. Great service work. Got one last reading. It's based on a passage from page 29. We've added a little something to it. Each individual in our personal stories describes it in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABAclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Larry comes down from North Georgia. Larry and I go to a lot of meetings together. I'll tell you what, when he goes over 3 minutes, he always gets away with it. He always has what we need to hear. And so tonight he's going to give us hopefully 45 minutes worth. I'm real proud to have my friend Larry come and tell you how he got sober, how he stays sober. Come on up here, Larry.
Hey, everybody. I'm Larry Flowers, and I'm an alcoholic. I bet some of y'all are, too. Y'all are all alcoholics, right? I mean, I just came down from the hills. I wanted to make sure I found the right place. It could be embarrassing at the end of this to find out I was in some other kind of meeting. I actually did that one time down in Columbus, Georgia. I was down there one night on business, or one day on business, and it ran along, and I was new to this thing, and I wanted to make sure I found a meeting, and I knew there was a meeting in this church, an AA meeting, and I saw some people sitting in a room, and they had some materials on the tables in front of them, and they were drinking coffee, and there was somebody up front leading them, and I thought, that's got to be it. I eased in the back door and stayed about 15 minutes, and I realized I was in a meeting of Al-Anon. I didn't say anything. I just eased on back out and got in my car and came to Gainesville. That's a bad joke. I've been to many Al-Anon meetings and gotten a lot from it. I'm just saying that in case there's any in here. I don't want you getting me after the meeting. I stumbled into an AA meeting December the 1st, 1990, at the Halt Club up in Gainesville. And picked up a white chip that first day I was there, and that's the last one I've had to pick up by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really liked what Tim read. I say a lot in the meetings up at my group is a friendship group up in Gainesville, meets at the Hall Club. And I say a lot up there that the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The result. I didn't know I needed a spiritual awakening when I showed up. I was 42 years old. I knew I needed something. I thought it was to not drink and a bag of money. And if I could get both of those, I'd be okay. I was sadly mistaken. I will tell you a little bit about my story, but I don't want to get too hung up in that part because the best part comes after I staggered into that AA meeting up in Gainesville. I was born on a sharecropper's farm up in West Tennessee, 1948. And my dad was a traveling alcoholic, one of those alcoholics, you know, gets a few drinks and disappears for 4 or 5 days or a week. And then my mom would get a call from New Orleans or Chicago or someplace to send him some money so he could get on a bus and come back home. He'd wake up there, been in a blackout, didn't have any money. And she did, for a while, she did. And when I was 5 years old, they got divorced, and I never saw him again until I was 19 years old, and I went to his funeral down in Milledgeville. And that kept me from going to Vietnam. I was three weeks away from shipping out to Nam and to carry a PRC field radio for the Marines and the Army over there. So I find it interesting that after not seeing him my whole life, he did me a much more solid at that moment than I realized. It took me a while in talking to some vets that did make it over there to realize what a good thing he did for me. I always knew I was going to drink. And drinking was not okay in my house. It had cost me a father, my mom, a husband. My mom didn't drink until after I was up in high school. She started drinking then. Grandparents didn't drink. Every once we lived with my grandparents. Grandfather was a sharecropper. Every once in a while, once or twice a year, he'd show up with a half pint in his pocket, spend some extra time down at the barn, and my grandmother would give him what for, and that'd be the end of that. But the by and large, drinking was not something that anybody ever, my family ever thought was a good thing. But I always knew I would drink. Always. I spent a lot of time being Roy Rogers or some of those guys, and I was always in the saloon. And I didn't think anything about it at the time, but I look back on it. I always knew I was going to drink. As I got older, I was waiting. And right all about the middle of the summer, before my freshman year in high school, we moved from this little bitty town that we lived close to. We didn't live in town. We lived close to it, where I had about 8 people in my 8th grade class, and we moved to Memphis, Tennessee. And the class that I joined when school started that freshman year, when it graduated in 1966, was the largest class to ever graduate from school in Tennessee. And to say that I was lost would be an understatement. My God, I'd never seen so many people. And I was lost for a while. But things got better. Some guys, because I'd never even seen a football or football game. We played basketball in Rutherford because you got 8 people in your 8th grade class. It's hard to put together a football team, but you can put together a basketball team. And so I played basketball forever, but never played football. But I was big, so I made it on the football team, still played basketball, ran track. And that's how I got my acceptance, was through sports. And it worked, and that was a good thing. I was a starting tackle on the football team. And I couldn't walk into the lunchroom by myself. That was a sign. I didn't know it at the time, but that was a sign. My sophomore year, that was a banner year. Now, that was a watershed year. My sophomore year, my buds and I, we'd managed to steal a little liquor from somebody's mom's and dad's bottle or something like that, or split a six-pack between 10 guys, you know. But never had really been able to drink enough to do anything till that year, my sophomore year. And we all started saving our money. we found somebody that would go and buy us some beer. Y'all remember those little bitty short cans of Country Club malt liquor? They still have them? Used to have them, little bitty short cans. And the rumor was they were in those short cans because it was stronger. It was malt liquor and it was stronger. Now, I have no idea if that was true or not, but that's what we thought. So we spent all the money we could scrape together. There was about five of us on Country Club malt liquor. And we went out on a country road. It was in the summertime, and we opened up the car doors and turned the AM radio up real loud. I don't know. Some of you in here, one or two, remember all that stuff. And lit up a cigarette and popped the top on a... Well, no, we didn't pop any tops. They hadn't been invented yet. We got the church key out and opened up some country club malt liquor. There was another sign. Everybody else was standing around the hood of that car smoking and joking and drinking those beers, and I took my, whatever my cut was, we divided up even, and it worked out to over a six-pack apiece, eight, nine beers apiece. And I took mine over away from everybody else. I didn't want anybody touching mine. And I knew, I intuitively knew that a magic moment was about to happen. And I poured that stuff down as quick as I could. And then I eased back over to the hood of that car where everybody else was. And you know, some of those guys, they didn't want all there. I took it. That was another sign, wasn't it? I didn't know. I had no idea. I didn't know that. And I got drunk that night. I got drunk. I didn't throw up. Didn't go into a blackout. Nothing bad happened. I woke up the next day with my head hurting a little and said, you know what I said. Hey, let's do that again. That was good. And that was it. That was the moment. And after that, whenever I could drink, I drank. And I always drank as much as I could every time I drank. And I remember the night of my junior year when my friend Ron and I both managed to finish a fifth. JTS Brown knocked out a fifth each of that. And we were so proud of ourselves. It was the first time we'd been able to do it. And I think we both threw up that night. But we managed to get it down. Another watershed moment. By the time my senior year rolled around, and sports were big in the school, we won. I have to work. Always have to find a way to work this in. We won the state football my sophomore year and senior year, so sports were big. Midway through the basketball season, though, and I love basketball, but I quit the team, and I didn't run track that year because it was interfering. It was interfering. The University of Tennessee played USC. At the Liberty Bowl in Memphis. University of Tennessee always plays one game in Memphis for the fans, Tennessee fans there. And they sent me sideline passes. And it sent me letters to recruit me to play football for them. I didn't go. I didn't have time. I had some other things going on that involved alcohol. It's another sign. See, it was starting to cost me. But I didn't know that. I didn't think it was costing me anything. Alcohol was the answer. Spin back to my freshman year. There was a buddy of mine, Andy and Tommy, and there was a group of us, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids in their basement on a Saturday playing some records. Tommy played the guitar. And it was soft drinks and cookies. His parents was there. It was nothing. And I ended up out behind the garage with a piece of glass trying to slice my wrist. And that was a sign. I had a lot of stuff cooking on the inside of me. That was a sign. When I found alcohol, it was the solution. And I've said many times, and I'll say standing here tonight, that I believe that alcohol kept me alive to find AA and find sobriety. I think without it, I would have taken my life a long time before I ever found AA or thought about a spiritual solution. But I kept on drinking. I started school at Memphis State that fall after I graduated from high school. I had two cousins that had an apartment right off the campus, and they were going to keep the apartment through the summer, but they weren't going to be there. And they told me that the rent's paid up if you want to go ahead and move in. Wow. Man, you know, me and my buds partied there all summer long. Drinking. Of course, I didn't make it through the first semester at Memphis State. Flunked out. Vietnam War was going on. I had a low number. So I joined the Air Force. Had some electronics training already. Thought I would be, maybe flying on a B-52 or KC-135 as a crewman. And finished basic electronics. Everything went good. I got into electronics. Went to a basic electronics school down in Keesler Air Force Base. And, I mean, I aced the school because I'd already had all that stuff. So I knew I was going to get something sweet. And there was one military occupation service number that I knew I didn't want. None of us wanted it. They were killing off the guys that carried the PRC radios, field radios in Vietnam so fast that the Army and Marines couldn't train them. And so they started pulling guys out of the Air Force and Navy and giving them a four-week course on the maintenance and operation of the PRC field radio. And that's where I went. I was on my way to Vietnam. And I was 19 years old, and I was drinking as much as I could, and I was miserable. I'd had a young lady that we'd gotten engaged. She'd gone off to college, and I'd gone off to the Air Force, and I got a dear John from her. I was miserable. And wanted to go to Vietnam. I was one of the few that was kind of celebrating it when it was announced. And then my dad died. And just like that, my mom called the Red Cross. The Red Cross contacted the Air Force. They put me on an airplane, put me on a bus, and I ended up down in Milledgeville. Went to his funeral. 30-day leave. Came back to Memphis and stayed drunk for 30 days. Went back down to Biloxi and continued to party and drink and as much as I could, every time I could. Got out of the Air Force, went back to school. Some other chemicals and things had shown up while I was away from Memphis. Wasn't much of that around in 1966, but when I got back, it was everywhere. And anything that would change the way I felt was good with me. Drinking was my best friend. I got married, got divorced. The girl that I'd gotten a Dear John letter from and when I was in the Air Force, that's kind of a good story. I don't get hung up on this stuff. But when I got back to Memphis after the Air Force, I had the engagement. She had sent me the engagement ring back, and I had it. And there was a guy. I was working at Braniff Airlines, loading cargo and going to school at night. And there was a guy there that never had bought his wife an engagement ring. And we got to talking, you know, guys sitting around at work. He found out I had the engagement ring. He said, "Man, I need to buy it. Sell it to me. Bring it out here and let me see it." So I brought it out. He carried it home to his wife. His wife loved it. He says, yeah, we want to buy it, man. Give me a good price on it. And, I'm sitting there talking to this guy. And I said, "No, I can't sell it." He said, "Why?" And I said, "Man, she's going to call me." He said, "How long has it been since you've talked to her?" And I said, "Oh, about 3.5-4 years." But she's gonna call you, huh? And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You just damn nuts." And maybe I was, but I got off work that morning at 11:30. Went home, got a shower. As soon as I got out of the shower, the phone was ringing. And I answered it. It was her. 2 months later, we got married. With her wearing an engagement ring. She was just as much a drunk as me. And 3 years later, that split up. Now, I got to tell you, I'm all this time, I'm miserable. My life is not working. I did not want to have a failed marriage. I grew up and that kind of stuff. I didn't want that. I wanted the marriage to work. I asked her if she'd consider maybe going to church and seeing if that might work for us. We hadn't been going. I hadn't been in church in years. She didn't want any part of that. We got divorced. I got on a fire department in Memphis and was, you know, you work a day, off a day, work a day, off a day, work a day, off 3 days. That was a lot of drinking and partying I could do. And I was doing it. It was just crazy, a really bad, awful lifestyle I was living. And got sick of it. Again, it's one of those weird things. I'm just going to tell you, I started coming home, sometimes drunk, and hitting my knees and telling God, I just want a family. I just want to get married. If I can get married and have a family and have kids, I wanted to have a boy. I wanted a son. I didn't have a dad, but I wanted to be a dad. One day, I called my mom. I got a new roommate, and I called up my mom, and her best friend, Joyce, had this big outbuilding back of their house. And I said, you think I got a new roommate? He's got some furniture. I've got a couple of pieces I need to store. Do you think Joyce would let me put that out back in her storeroom? Oh, I'm sure she would. She said, come by and get me. I'll visit with Joyce while you do this. So she called Joyce. Everything was fine. I went back, got my mom. We went over to Joyce's. I put the furniture in a big storehouse out back. When I came inside, it's late in the afternoon, and they sent me to the store to get a couple of pizzas and a six-pack. They were hungry, wanted to drink a beer and eat some pizza. I said, okay. I go get a pizza, six-pack. We're sitting there, and Joyce's oldest daughter came in. Now, Joyce's oldest daughter was 4 years younger than me. I'd been around her growing up the whole time I was in school, a little old bitty buck-toothed, big-eyed, skinny little thing. Now, never paid any attention to her. She came walking in from work. She was 21 years old. She wasn't buck-toothed or skinny anymore, but still had those big old eyes and some other things that were nice. And I'm going to tell you, and I'm dating a girl that my mother was all upset because she had some children and she just knew I was going to marry this girl, and I probably was. But when her name's Barbara, when Barbara walked in that kitchen that day, I knew. Now, she was engaged to a guy going to school at the University of Tennessee. And I knew that, too. I knew all about it. It's like she knew all about me. Our moms were best friends. We'd grown up around each other. I knew she was dating this guy, and I'm sitting at that table scheming just as hard as I can how I'm going to see her again. So I invited the whole family over to my new apartment for an apartment warming party. Her mom is Cajun, and I said to my soon-to-be mother-in-law, I said, you know, why don't y'all come over Friday night? You make some of that good gumbo and red beans and rice, and I'll get some shrimp, and we'll boil that and have a little apartment warming party. Oh, yeah, that'll be fun. I said, be sure and bring the kids. I didn't care about one kid. She was sitting right across the table from me, but I made that point several times, and she showed up that night, and she had Barbara with her. And my date was there, so I was kind of limited on moves. I had some moves. I was young. I had some moves in those days. I had any moves today. I had some moves in those days. And so finally, after we finished eating and everything, I saw her go out and sit down on the couch out in the living room of the apartment. Nobody else was in there, so I eased on out there and sat down next to her. And I tell this story in front of Barbara on a regular basis. Tim hadn't heard it yet, but he probably will one day because I like to tell it in front of her. You'll see why. But I sit down next to her, and I said, well, so you still dating that guy? You been dating for so long? Oh, yeah, engaged. He goes to school up at UT in Knoxville, doesn't he? Oh, yeah. I said, do you ever go out on him? She said, what? I said, don't get mad. I just, you know, just checking. She's shaking her head, you know, doing that kind of thing, rolling her eyes around. And I said, well, there's a band playing at this bar right down the street tomorrow night. I really like them. You want to go? She said, yeah. And I said, I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock. A week later, she broke up with him. I broke up with her. 3 months later, we got married, and we've been married now be 40 years this August. Prayers were getting answered in those days. Prayers were getting answered. She got pregnant right away. She got pregnant again, and two little girls, and had some problems then. We couldn't have any more kids. That little boy wasn't going to make it. Now, what was interesting, her dad, I knew her dad well. When I came back from my dad's funeral on the bus from Milledgeville, her dad picked me up at the bus depot and brought me home. But her dad had died right a year before we got married. So I was the oldest male in the family. As I like to say it, I was the guy who always had to carve the turkey at the meals, you know, the oldest male. Well, I would sit and drink at night and get drunk and get mad at God about that, ruminating, you know, what is the deal, God? What is the deal? I don't have a dad. My wife doesn't have a dad. And, you know, male influences in my life just haven't been around. I've tried to make a dad. I was starting to realize I've been trying to make dads out of everybody I'd ever met. It didn't work very well. When you're drinking the way I was drinking, I wasn't in places to meet the kind of guys you'd want to pick as a dad. Now that you're sober, you wouldn't anyway. But anyway, we stayed married, and I started to work for a little bitty insurance company that grew into a multi-billion dollar company, and I was there at the right time, at the right place, and they kept moving me up, and that's how we ended up in Georgia. The promotion had two or three good promotions, ended up with a heck of a good job. When we came to Georgia, Barbara and I neither one had ever lived anywhere, but, you know, basically, I mean, I'd grown up in the country, but basically everything was in Memphis, all of our friends, all of our family. We moved to Georgia with our two little girls. And my drinking by that time, people were noticing. People were noticing. The people I worked with, when I was going around to their offices at 4 o'clock and saying, y'all want to go have a drink this afternoon? And so, yeah, I'd be okay. We'll get off work. We'll go have a drink. And I said, well, no, how about right now? And they go, man, it's 3:30. You need to wait till 5 or 5:30 and we'll go. What's the matter right now? I'm going to go on over and I'll meet you all over there, okay? I'll save a seat. People were noticing. But I was doing a good job. I was still performing. We have to, right? We've got to keep the money coming in so we can keep drinking, keep the facade up. I was doing some other things. I was back. It was exactly what I wanted. I had everything I'd ever dreamed of. We had a nice home, the nicest home by far that I'd ever lived in. I had a good job. I had a beautiful wife. I had two incredibly beautiful daughters that loved me. And I couldn't maintain. It was starting to all slip away. I'm trying to figure out a way to do what I had to do. But at this point, I wasn't doing it because I wanted to anymore. I was doing it because I had to do it. I didn't know how not to do it. So I got a chance to move to Georgia. I came down here by myself for about 3 months till the kids got out of school and I could buy a house. And you know, here's one of those moments. My brother-in-law came down to visit with me. And when he walked in, I was staying in a little rented, little small apartment. And when he walked in, he got to walk around looking at this little place where I was staying, waiting for the family to come down, and there was a bottle of scotch, bottle of bourbon, a couple of cases of beer, there was a quart of Stoli in the freezer, you know, all the stuff. And there was some other chemicals there too, and he looked at all that and said, how many people live in here? Truthfully, and I said, well, just me. He said, my God, you bought all that for you? You know, I see, it didn't look like that much to me. It was another one of those moments. But I was starting to know I was in trouble. And now I'm here in Georgia. And I don't know anybody. And it's starting to get real bad, real bleak. I'm just having trouble maintaining. And I've got this new big job. And I'm scared to death. I'm scared to death. And I went to a doctor about 8 or 9 months after we moved in. I went to a doctor. I'd been taking some doctor-prescribed just little things to help me along, you know. try to make the shakes go away and the hangovers go away. So I go to a doctor in Gainesville to get some refills. Because what I was doing is I had a druggist in Memphis that would refill these. I could call a doctor in Memphis who would call them into this druggist, and the druggist would FedEx them to me in Gainesville. That's a pretty hard supply line to keep going and not run out when you're in the state that I was in most of the time. So I went to a doctor in Gainesville to make it easier. And he took a look. First he said, I'll give you a 30-day supply, but I need your medical records from your doctor in Memphis. Well, I had about three doctors that was calling him in, so... Yeah, that's not a problem. I get him one doctor's medical records, and he looks at those when I go back the next month, and he says, you got a problem. You're addicted to these. Well, I was so offended. What in the world do you mean, addicted? He said, yeah, we need to taper you off. Taper me off? Who do you think you're talking to? Well, the time I got home, I walked out. The time I got home, he had called my wife, ratted me out. You know, so I had to keep that same thing going at home. I'm not addicted. Yeah, I'm just going to quit. And I did. I laid on the couch for about 30 days, shaking, screaming into a pillow. But I quit. I quit all of it. Everything, even booze. I didn't, it was in August, from August to Thanksgiving, I didn't put anything in. I couldn't hold a cup of coffee for about 2 months. Shaking so bad, but I cold turkeyed off all of it. Hid it from my boss, made up a disease, hid everything from him so I could get back at work. Went home Thanksgiving, my brother-in-law, who was a big-time attorney up there, well, still is, and he always had some of the best, that weed stuff you roll up, he always had some of that, and I hadn't been sleeping. I think I'd slept maybe 8 hours in 3 months, to tell you the truth. When you're shaking and jittering, it's hard to sleep. And he said, well, this will help. And we smoked some. And he was right, it did. And I brought some back. And a few months, I was right back where I was. And I caught myself walking out of a doctor's office with some scripts. And I did not want to go through that part again. I just didn't want to go through that again. It was too hard. I didn't think I could live through it again. See, I didn't know anything about the 30-day programs or any. I had no idea any of that existed. Well, I had some good friends of ours in Memphis that had a miracle, a healing miracle, and I'm not going to go into it, with their daughter. And she had the before and after x-rays, and they had shown them to us when we'd been in Memphis visiting that weekend, that summer. And I got to thinking about that. And there was a retreat coming up at our church, and my wife had been trying to get me to go to it, and finally I agreed that I would. And I went, and for the first time in my life, I told another human being that I was an alcoholic, and that was a priest at my church. And he was a non-alcoholic. And he gave me the best advice that a non-alcoholic can give. He said, well, don't drink anymore. And he blessed me. And I said, well, okay. That's cool. Well, the retreat ended on Sunday night with a big meal there. I'm Catholic now. We don't serve grape juice. It's a real thing. And so we had a meal there in the cafeteria, and they had wine. And he said, not drink. And I'm looking around, this, all the other guys that have been in this retreat with me, they all got a glass of wine. But is a glass of wine with a meal, is that drinking? And I thought, well, I guess not. Even the priest had a glass. So I figured, I'm okay. And y'all know what happened, right? I will never forget that night, sitting in the bathtub after my wife and kids were in bed with a bottle of scotch, drinking out of the bottle, crying like a baby. Drunk again. And I didn't think it was going to happen again. I really didn't. The next Monday, after this retreat, we were supposed to set up prayer groups. And I went to a buddy's office. Four of us were going to meet there. at lunch. Deal was, you bring a sandwich, and we'll eat the sandwich together and have some prayer time together. And when I walked in, he had a tape playing. It was a cassette tape. Didn't have CDs. Cassette tape. And this guy was telling his story. It was a tape he wanted us to hear about this healing ministry, but nobody else was listening to it but me. And I'll never forget it. And this priest was saying to this fellow that they'd prayed over, and he didn't drink anymore. And he was telling a story about how he didn't drink anymore. And he said, "Why didn't you drink anymore?" He said, "Well, because I realized after y'all prayed over me, I've been so filled with the presence of God that drinking broke that conscious contact I had with God. And I wanted the conscious contact with God more than I wanted the booze." And I started crying. I'm sitting there with my guys, and I got tears running down my face, and they're saying, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "I'm okay. I promise I'm okay, but I got to go." And I got up and I walked in. I didn't go to a treatment center. I didn't go to the church. I went to the library and I checked out everything I could find on alcoholism. I had 3 books on alcoholism. Brought them home, laid on the couch for the rest of the week and read those books. And all 3 of them said the same thing, basically. AA works. I called the contact number. There was an AA meeting less than a mile from my house. Drove down there 3 days in a row. Walked in the 3rd day. Came back from that meeting and told my wife, "I think I have found a way to stay sober. I don't think I'm going to have to drink anymore." I walked into that first AA meeting and I was at home. And I just knew it. Just like when that beautiful little girl walked in that kitchen, I knew she was going to be my wife. I knew when I walked in that meeting I was at home. But what I had been looking for, but what I needed, I had found. My oldest girl was 17. Now, this was December the 1st, 1990. It wasn't just the men that went on this retreat. The 2nd week in January, the women had a retreat like that. It's called Christ Renews His Parish. My wife went on that retreat. When we had gone to Memphis, okay, I'll tell you this story. I'm a little bit selfish. Just a little. 3 weeks sober, we're driving up to Memphis, right, for the holidays. I'm 3 weeks sober. I got 2 little girls in the back seat. "Don't touch me. You're looking at me." I'm not in a good place for the time we've been in that. You know, it's an 8-hour drive. 45 minutes into it, I'm not in a good place. Halfway there, I say to my wife, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can go up here and stay sober. Everybody's going to be drinking and doing some other stuff." She said, "Well, my brother's in AA." And I had forgotten she had her oldest brother had gotten sober in AA. And I said, "Oh my God, I forgot Clayton's in AA." We get there about 6:30. We go in, the family is in, and mom-in-law's drunk. And I grabbed Clayton and I drug him to one of the back bedrooms. And I said, "Clayton, guess what?" He said, "What?" I'm 3 weeks. He said, "What?" I said, "I joined AA." He went, "Well, that's good." That was the wrong reaction. And I said, "Clayton, I need to go to a meeting." He said, "Okay, well, sometime while y'all are here, we'll go to a meeting." I said, "No, man, I need to go to a meeting tonight. Okay, you wouldn't believe the trip I had down. I got to go to a meeting." He said, "Oh, man," he said, "Lee, I don't go to those meetings anymore. I'm drinking." And I thought about that for a couple of seconds, and I said, "I don't give a damn. I need you to carry me to a meeting. I don't know where they are. You need to carry me to one." I love Clayton, and he loves me. He said, "All right, come on." And we got in his car, and Clayton picked up a white chip. And the next Christmas, when we went back, he picked up another white chip. And the next Christmas, he picked up another white chip. And a few years ago, I gave him his 5-year chip. So it took a while, but old Clayton got it too. And my oldest daughter, 17, she was wearing us out to get back to Georgia before New Year's Eve. And I knew why, because I already knew what she was. She was the same thing as her daddy. Any questions about that? Matter of fact, we got back home. I told her, I said, I know why you want to get back here. Just be safe. And I looked right in the eye, and I told her something I'd heard Chuck C. say. I started listening to Chuck C. my first week in the program. And I said, I'm not going to ever demand anything of you ever again. But I think I found a way to stay sober. And if you ever want it, if you let me know, I'll take you to it. And that was it. My wife goes on, second week in January, my wife goes on this trip, this retreat. My youngest daughter was spending a weekend with a friend. My oldest girl is going to be there with me. And I said, darling, Saturday night, why don't you and I go out to dinner? She said, okay. And I said, just don't drink before we go. I don't drink anymore. And I'd rather not be around it. And she said, okay. Well, when we were getting ready to go, we passed each other in the hall. She'd been out with some friends. And I smelled booze on her. And I said, oh, I really wish you hadn't drank. She said, Daddy, I didn't. And I said, well, I'm just going to say what I said before. If you ever have a problem and you want some help, let me know. 5 minutes later, she's tapping on my bedroom door. I open the door. She's crying. She said, I got a problem. I'm 2 months sober at this point, or a month and a half sober. Okay, you got a problem. Now, what do I do? My wife's not here. What do I do, you know? And I called the hall club, and it was a woman there named Esther, and Esther had double-digit sobriety. And Esther was there at the club, and I said, I need to bring my daughter up and let you talk to her. And Esther talked to her and came back out, and she said, she needs to go in treatment. And I said, Esther, Mama's at church on a weekend retreat, won't be home till tomorrow night. What do I do? Do I just take her over to the emergency room, get her in the treatment center, or do I go get her mama? I'll never forget. Esther's gone on now, but Esther looked at me and said, I don't think you want her mama coming home from church and find out you put her little girl in a treatment center for 30 days. Go get your wife. And I said, oh, okay. Yes. Another one of these things. Now, I walk in the church, one of the ladies who was helping to moderate the weekend saw, and I knew her well, and Jennifer and I came through the door. She looked up and saw us, and she started crying. And she said, I'll be right back. She never asked me why I was there. She just said, I'll be right back. She went downstairs. A few minutes later, here comes my wife with two or three. Mm. 9 o'clock is my bedtime. I'm getting tired. I don't usually do that anymore. My wife came up, two or three other ladies, all crying. I started trying to tell my wife why I was there, and she said, I know. How would you know? You know? And so we drive over to the hospital emergency room, and they do what they do. They put my daughter in 30-day treatment center. I said to my wife, do you want to go home or go back to the church? She said, no, I'm going to go back to the church. I said, okay. And I never asked her, between there and the church, how did you know? What was going on? The next night, they had a dinner for the ladies, like they had for us. I did not drink the wine this time. I said, how did you know? She said, when we started the retreat, Father asked us to write down something that we really wanted everybody to pray for and share it with everybody else. And we'd all pray for that all weekend. And I wrote down if Jennifer had a problem. Did I say 9 o'clock is my bedtime, so I get full time? If Jennifer had a problem, she'd ask for help. So when you are, when you are, you were there, and I'm a girl sober. And I got to spend some time with her today. Tim's seen her come to the meetings every once in a while up there with me. But she's sober. I wish there were words that I could tell you. She married a guy from the program. He's sober. I think about how those family gatherings used to be in Memphis with a bunch of people high, a bunch of people drunk, somebody getting an argument, somebody getting a fight. We have those at our house now. Talk program. Go to a meeting together after we eat. How sweet is that? I wish I could tell you about all the other things that's happened. I never got that bag of money. You know, I had some good times and bad times, money. I've had a lot of money and lost a lot of money. I don't care. Because what I've discovered along the way is I'm always given everything I need. I'm getting ready to turn 65. I have no idea how that happened. I look at my hands and I look at myself in the mirror sometimes. What is going on? I made a mistake a few times saying to my wife. She said, "What do you mean?" I said, look at me. She said, "You're getting old." Well, that ain't the answer I was looking for. And what I've discovered is I am not, and I never have been, who I think I am. I have never been. I am not right now who I think I am. It's not possible for me to see me. I can't do it. I've worked with that one a long time now, and I can't see me. I don't know who I am, but I figured out something else along the way. I don't have to know. It's not important. I'm loved. I am held in the palm of His hand. I am given everything I need. The whole thing is a miracle. Every single bit of it. They're occurring around me all the time. All I have to do is to remember to look for them. And the finest and greatest thing that's ever happened to me has happened in the rooms of AA. That has been the catalyst for every good thing that's happened. So I'll close this by saying what I always try to remember to say. You read your way through the big book. If it says do this, do it. If it says write this down, write it down. If it says pray this, pray it. If it says tell this to somebody, tell it to them. Get yourself a good sponsor that's done that, that's worked the steps. And what it says in that 12th step will come true in your life. You'll have that spiritual awakening. You'll have it. And once you have it, you can walk away from it. I did at one point. Didn't drink, didn't get sober. Got some resentments. My wife looked at me one day and said, "You know, you're starting to act just like you did before you went in the program." And that set me back. I had to stop and think for a while, and she was right. See, I go to a meeting every day. Very rarely do I miss one. But I had stopped doing that for a while. And so I had to spend some time and think, and I came back and told her, "You're right. You're right, but I know where the answer is." And I went back into my home group, and I'm back here as a newcomer. I'd gotten too big in AA. I'd been GSR, I'd been there, you know, DCM, I'd done all that, and I knew too much, and I'd gotten too big, and it bit me on the butt. You can't get big in this program. It bit me on the butt, and I said, "I'm back as a newcomer, and a newcomer I'm going to stay wherever, how long God leaves me here." It's an honor always to be invited to share my story. I wish it was more exciting. I never was arrested. Never was shot at. Never shot at anybody. You know, it's a pretty dull story, but it's always an honor to share it. Tim, I thank you for inviting me, and I thank you guys for listening.
Thank you, Larry. I guess about a year ago, I ran into you at a halfway house where you had brought a meeting in, and somebody told me, "You ought to come to this meeting. This guy Larry's going to come in and run the meeting for us." I wasn't sure it was going to be you, but I was glad it was. And I had known you, And watching you work in the trenches is incredible. It's what you do for the guys in Gainesville. They hit the program. They might be retreads. They're just hanging on by the fingernails, and really give them the kind of hope and guidance that just listening to them, being with them, is awesome. Okay, Michael, I got the chips laid up right here. You ready?
Good evening. My name is Michael, recovering alcoholic. Here at the 8 p.m. speaker meeting, we have a chip system. Would anyone like a white chip to start a new way of life? Anyone else?
And we'll all be together on that broad highway.